Yeah, so this weekend, the theme of this weekend, as we've made fairly plain by now, is the Sutra of Golden Light, this ancient Buddhist text called the Sutra of Golden Light. And the weekend is very much based around that text. And this evening we'll be doing a ritual, a puja, that's effectively a sort of cut down, condensed version of the Sutra of Golden Light, in which we'll be entering the mythic, magical realm of this sutra, and hopefully experiencing a bit of its transformative effects. So my aim in this talk is to tell you about this sutra, to bring out its inner meaning, and its relevance to us. Its relevance to us as Buddhist practitioners in the 21st century, so that we can participate fully in this evening's ritual. But first, I'd like to give a bit of background. I'd like to say something about this sutra, this ancient text, in a sort of general way. Because it's important to appreciate that this is historically a very, very important text in the Buddhist tradition, not just in our tradition, but in the Buddhist tradition, certainly in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, tradition of what we might call Northern Buddhism. And just how important is shown by the very, very large number of manuscripts that have been found all over the Buddhist world in all sorts of remote places. And also by the number of languages it's been translated into. So manuscripts have been dug out of ancient Buddhist ruins, of old temples and monasteries and abandoned cities, or unearthed in ancient libraries that have been buried, you know, along ancient trade routes in deserts, in cities that no longer exist. Not just in the usual Sanskrit and Tibetan and Chinese and Japanese, but also in languages like Mongolian, Uyghur, however you pronounce that, somebody can tell me, Sogdian, Khotanese, Tsia, anyone tell me where that comes from? I don't know. So, you know, all over the Buddhist world, all over the Buddhist world. And this very great popularity, the very great popularity of this sutra seems to be based on the fact that just about everywhere in the Northern Buddhist world, it was traditionally seen as having a magical blessing quality. So that chanting this sutra, engaging with this sutra, brought blessings on the people who took part. It blessed them. It blessed their environment. It protected their country. It brought abundance, protection, good fortune, positive qualities. In many parts of the Buddhist world, the sutra was chanted publicly in the main square of the town or city in times of threat or trouble. The Emperor Shomu of Japan in 741 set up a monastery in every single province of Japan with the express aim of chanting this sutra on a regular schedule to bring harmony and abundance to the state. And this view of this sutra as having this sort of magical blessing quality, this harmonizing quality, it's not just confined to the ancient Buddhist world. Actually, if you go on the web and look this sutra up on the web, you will see this plethora of websites recommending that people learn and spread and chant this sutra to bring everything from world peace to better health. You can hear it chanted in Tibetan on YouTube. On one website, when I looked, 30,322 people had pledged to learn and recite the sutra for the welfare of the world. It's probably more now, because that was about 2 days ago. And trawling through all these many websites, you see it recommended, you see engaging with this sutra recommended as a way of purifying environmental pollution, protecting from disasters and terrorism, improving the political situation, bringing national harmony, purifying bad accumulated karma, calming mental disturbances and curing mental illness. Not bad. The website of one Tibetan teacher says that if enough of us engage wholeheartedly with this sutra, China will return to Buddhism and it will lay off Tibet. Wouldn't that be nice? Another website asks people to contribute to its project of making this sutra freely available in hospitals and psychiatric institutions because of its calming effect on mental disturbances. So, are all these people mad and deluded? These people in the 21st century, setting up websites like this, and going back more than 1500 years in time to ancient Buddhist cities where it would be chanted in the main square. Is all this just a load of tosh? Just a load of empty superstition? Or is there something behind it? Is there something behind it? Can and could engaging with this sutra really have some sort of blessing quality? Could it really protect and bless and bring abundance and positive qualities? And for me, the answer to this question is yes. And my talk is about why this is, and how we can get some of it. How we can get some of it this weekend. How we can get some of this blessing by spending a weekend or longer immersing ourselves in this magical, mythic sutra. And by engaging with it tonight in our puja. So as I've said, this is a hugely important sutra in the Buddhist tradition. And it seems having this magical quality of bringing blessings and harmony and positive states. So we're probably really excited. We're probably really excited by it and we want to go out and buy it. And whenever I see anybody buy this sutra, my heart sinks. So we might be really excited and go out and buy it and pick it up and read it. And then we are likely to be just really, really puzzled. Because this is on first sight a very odd document indeed. It's a very odd thing indeed. It can seem a hodgepodge of bizarre and unconnected scraps. It's got spells. It's got invocations. It's got magical recipes. It's got apparently irrelevant stories. It's got discourses on ancient traditional medicine. It's got instructions for an instruction for a ritual for helping the spread of the Dharma by bathing in herbal infusions while waited upon by beautiful virgins. I think we should adopt this. I think this would be a cracking practice, actually. So, Sangharakshita says of this sutra that at first sight it seems just a rag bag, a transcendental rag bag, he seems, a rag bag full of beautiful jewels and valuable treasures and all sorts of fascinating odds and ends, but still a rag bag. But he says that somewhere in this rag bag is a core, a central jewel, something very, very precious indeed. An analogy that occurs to me, apart from a rag bag, is that this sutra is like a beautiful jewel, a beautiful, huge jewel, which has been at the bottom of the sea for ages and ages. It's encrusted all over with barnacles and limpets and mussels and coral and seaweed. And you can hardly see the jewel at the centre. When you first pick it up, you think, lump of sea stuff. But somehow, yeah, you can hardly see the jewel at the centre of this incrustation, but somehow the radiance still shines out from the jewel at the centre. You can sort of feel, you might not understand this sutra, you can sort of feel something coming out of it, some light coming out of it. You can still sense there's something very valuable underneath it all, if you could just scrape away all the limpets. And actually, that's not a bad image, although I invented it myself. As Sangharakshita has pointed out, there's a core to this sutra. There's an original sutra which describes an important transformative spiritual experience, an experience that can indeed bring harmony and blessings to the person who experiences it and can bring harmony and blessings to their world. And this is the jewel. But over the centuries, masses of stuff has been added, masses of stuff has been encrusted on the outside. Some of these additions actually add to the original core. They're like crystals that have grown onto another crystal and sort of add to it organically. Harmoniously, but much of what's added is just incrustation, like seaweed and limpets on a jewel, and just hides the real meaning. And what I'm going to talk about, actually, if you want to know more about the sort of incrustation, if you like, and what's the core, Sangharakshita's book, The Eternal Legacy, is really good on this. But what I'm going to talk about for the rest of this core is the beautiful core of jewels, and not the other stuff. And that's what I've tried to bring out in the condensed version of the sutra that we're going to use as a ritual this evening. We're just going to engage with this central spiritual experience, this central core, with the other stuff stripped away. Okay. So, the sutra's got a core. What actually happens in the core of this sutra? Well, like all sutras, it opens with the Buddha. But not the historical Buddha, not the man who walked around India, not the Buddha of the Pali Canon. It opens with the archetypal Buddha, the transcendental Buddha, the Buddha principle, sitting in his pure land, sitting, if you like, in another dimension of experience, surrounded by an assembly of all sorts of beings, some very strange indeed. And at the beginning of the sutra, the voice of the Buddha resounds out from this other dimension. It resounds out right throughout time in our dimension. With the following message, it says, "I will now expound the excellent sutra of golden light, the king of sutras, which has been blessed by all the Buddhas in the four directions, which destroys all evils, which shatters every misfortune, which confers every blessing, and which leads to wisdom. For beings in the unfortunate states, for those involved in conflict, for those oppressed by circumstances, for those whose face is turned away from the good, for those in grief and trouble, for those in poverty or bad health, for those afflicted by evil influences, for those tormented by their own minds, for those who are worried, in the grip of craving, in the grip of anxiety, in the grip of demons, for all those whose life is like an evil dream full of trouble, for you I resound this sutra. Because for all you who hear this sutra with pure minds and good intentions, for all you such misfortunes will be destroyed forever. The world protectors themselves will watch over you, and the gods and powers of nature will protect you day and night without end. I will resound this sutra, this deep Buddha field, down all the ages, and it will ripen the merit roots of all those whose ears it enters." So that's quite a promise. And then suddenly the scene shifts. And we're in a town. We're in the town of Rajagriha, probably in the area where the Buddha, the actual historical Buddha, walked around and taught. And we're in the house of a practitioner called Ricchiraketu. Maybe not long after the Parinirvana, the passing away of the Buddha. And when we first meet him, Ricchiraketu is troubled. He's troubled by doubts. He's meditating on the Buddha. His mind is focused on the Buddha. But he's troubled. And he's troubled by the question, why did the Buddha die? Why did the Buddha pass into final nirvana? In effect, why has the Buddha left us alone? And this question, why did the Buddha die? Why did the Buddha only live to be 80? Why did he die? Is one that crops up over and over again in scriptures and texts written down after the Buddha's death. And this wasn't a bit of sort of obscure Buddhological theorizing about whether or not the Buddha had power to prolong his own life. wasn't a bit of obscure, a bit of theorizing. It was a burning, practical, spiritual question for many people. It was a vitally important question for their practice. It was about how, with the Buddha dead, the actual historical Buddha dead, can I have a direct living connection with the ideal, with spiritual reality, with the spiritual reality the Buddha represented? How can this connection with the ideal be a living source of energy, of inspiration, of strength, of clarity, of purpose, of a sense of sureness, that in the way that people had when the Buddha was actually alive? So for those lucky enough to be around at the time of the Buddha, to spend time with the Buddha was a living, breathing spiritual reality right in front of their eyes. It was a living reality that could be a source of inspiration, a source of certainty, knowledge, sureness about what we were doing, clarity of purpose, strength. And some of the Buddha's disciples, even while he was alive, couldn't actually be with the Buddha. So they were cut off from that living ideal. And for these disciples, the act of meditating on the Buddha and his qualities was an important practice as a way of having some form of contact, connection, direct living connection with that spiritual reality. So we've got the example, for example, in the Pali Canon of an old man called Pingya, who crops up in a very moving passage in the Sutta Nipata. And Pingya is too old and decrepit to travel and see the Buddha, but he spends all his time meditating on the Buddha and his qualities, revering the Buddha. So he says, so that there is not one moment that he is not in the Buddha's presence. And Pingya describes his practice, and then although Pingya isn't physically with the Buddha seems to be aware of his practice. Buddha seems to be aware of Pingya and what he's thinking and saying, and he tells Pingya to keep up this practice. He sort of appears to Pingya's mind and says, keep up this practice. He says, Pingya, other people have been liberated by the power of Shraddha. If you don't know what Shraddha is, I'm going to say a little bit more later. Other people have been liberated by the power of Shraddha. Other people, Pingya, have been carried to enlightenment by the power of Shraddha. You too should let that power release you. At which Pingya is completely overjoyed. He's absolutely delighted. And he bursts out joyfully, I too will go there. I too will go beyond. You may consider this as mind released. So if even while the Buddha was alive, disciples like Pingya felt the need to focus their mind in meditation on the Buddha, mindfulness on the Buddha and his qualities, as a way of keeping a living connection with something beyond themselves, something higher than their present state, it's not surprising that after the Buddha's death, this practice of meditating on the Buddha, focusing the mind on the Buddha and his qualities, became a really important practice for practitioners all over the Buddhist world. As it obviously is for Rūchira Kētu in the Sutra of Golden Light, because that's what we find him doing when we meet him. He's meditating on the Buddha. And this practice of mindfulness of the Buddha was widely recommended in just about all schools as a practice that could take you all the way to enlightenment. And even if it doesn't take you all the way to enlightenment, it was said to have a host of other benefits. Most importantly, it was said that it makes your mind tend towards the plane of the Buddhas. It makes your mind tend towards the plane of the Buddhas. So the act of meditating on the Buddha, having the Buddha as a factor in your mind, makes your mind more like the Buddha's mind. It raises the level of your being towards the plane of the Buddhas. It gives you a little taste of the realm of the Buddhas, of what it would be like. So if we can't live in the realm of the Buddhas, if we can't live on that level yet, we can at least get a tourist visa to that realm. We can have a brief stay on a sort of rather dingy hotel in the outskirts, perhaps, but still get some of the atmosphere of that realm, which will actually transform us. make us more an inhabitant of that realm. Because what we dwell on, that we become. That's a sort of standard spiritual truth. If we dwell on the Buddha, we become more like the Buddha. We enter his realm. Our mind tends to dwell on the plane of the Buddha's. So this practice of meditating on the Buddha became one of the most important practices after the Buddha's death. But many people then, like many people now, found that this practice doesn't seem to be just an imaginative exercise. Okay, we start by imagining the Buddha, working with the intellect, calling his qualities to mind. But it doesn't seem to stop there. For many people, it doesn't seem to be just a sort of psychological exercise. It seems to connect us with something real, something powerful, something beyond our own little personality, not just something that we've conjured up with our imagination. It seems to connect us with something powerful that can be a source of real inspiration, even a source of teaching and guidance, a source of clarity of purpose, just as the Buddha was when he was alive. And that isn't a theory. It's not a theory that I'm coming up with, and I wouldn't actually like to have to defend it logically. I wouldn't like to explain how that works, but it's just many people's actual spiritual experience. Starting with Pingya, among others, but extending right up to the present day. Many people have the experience that by meditating on the Buddha or some other symbol or something else which gives us access to this higher reality, this spiritual reality, there is an active, living spiritual reality that we can have a connection with. In a sense, the Buddha is still alive and can be contacted. And the faculty by which we do that, by which we have that contact, by which we have that connection with spiritual reality, is what is called Shraddha. In our sutra at the moment, Rūtara Kētu is meditating on the Buddha, but he doesn't seem to have that access to spiritual reality, that living access. He's wondering, why is the Buddha dead? Symbolically, why is the Buddha dying? Why is the Buddha dead? So, okay, what is this Shraddha? Just very briefly, what is it for those that haven't come across it before? Usually translated as faith, which is a really dreadful translation, given some of the connotations of sort of Christian faith. Sangharakṣita describes Shraddha as the response of what is ultimate in us to what is ultimate in the universe. The response of what is ultimate in us to what's ultimate in the universe. It's a sort of intuitive response, an intuitive echo in us from something outside us. A sort of intuitive heart knowledge. We could describe it as our love and admiration for spiritual qualities and for higher values that are precious to us. The values and qualities that we place our heart on, build our lives on. So we could say it's our love and admiration for spiritual beauty. And as such, it's very, very closely related to our response to physical beauty, our response to beauty in nature and the arts. So getting back to what Sangharakṣita's definition of Shraddha as the response of what is ultimate in us to what's ultimate in the universe, we can think of Shraddha as a link. It's a connection. A connection to something beyond ourselves. Shraddha is our connection to what is, if you like to use that analogy, higher. It's our connection to what is higher, to the spiritual ideal, which can bring it into our direct experience and make it a living reality for us. So it's a connection, it's a thread between us and the plane of the Buddhas, between us and a higher plane of reality. And it brings that higher plane into our direct experience. It makes it a living reality for us. For us, if we have Shraddha, the Buddha is not dead. It gives us a sense of direction, a source of inspiration, strength, and clarity of purpose. It sorts our life out. If we've got Shraddha, the Buddha is alive for us. And the Buddha told Pingya that he could allow this power, the power of his Shraddha, to release him. If he strengthened this link, this connection, it would become strong enough to pull him to enlightenment. What's ultimate in the universe would pull what is ultimate in him to enlightenment. So strengthening this link between what's ultimate in us and what's ultimate in the universe is the key to making real spiritual progress. And we'll come back to that a little bit. Getting back to our sutra, we left Ruchirakhetu meditating on the Buddha, doing this practice that became so important after the Buddha's death, but he's troubled. Why, he is thinking, did the Buddha die? Why isn't the Buddha a living reality for me? Why did he leave us alone? So for Ruchirakhetu at that moment, the Buddha is not alive. He's not a living spiritual reality. It all maybe seems a bit remote, a bit distant. And we probably often feel like that ourselves. Okay, we believe the Buddha was enlightened, but he's been dead for a very long time, and there isn't much sometimes in our present experience to inspire us to be the person we could be, to make us sure that's the direction. So Ruchirakhetu is in the situation that maybe a lot of us are in a lot of the time, feeling that the ideal's not a living force in his life, wondering why the Buddha's dead. So we might be like that, but Ruchirakhetu is described in the sutra as a great being of great merit. So for him, meditating on the Buddha, the question is answered in a way that it might not be answered for us. Okay. So here he is, he's meditating on the Buddha, feeling this lack of direct connection, focused on this question, why did the Buddha die? And he gets an answer. He gets an answer in no uncertain terms. He doesn't get a sort of bit of a feeling that he can connect with something beyond himself. He doesn't get a bit of a feeling. He doesn't get a little tiny whisper in his ear saying, it's okay. It's okay. You're not alone. There's help there. We might be really glad to get that. But this isn't what happens to Ruchirakhetu. No. No subtle feeling. No little whisper. There he is meditating. The walls of his house vanish. His house extends to infinity. The parts of his house that are left are transformed into light. They become precious jewels, full of light, shining with light. And somewhere out in the infinite space that extends in all directions, four enormous thrones made of light appear. One in each of the cardinal directions. On each a throne appears a gigantic lotus made of light. And on each lotus appears a gigantic Buddha made of light, shining with light. And throughout space, the voices of these four Buddhas resound, saying with one massive voice, the drops of water in the ocean can be counted, but no one can count the life of the Buddha. The atoms in the earth can be counted, but no one can count the years in the Buddha's life. Even the sky can be measured, but there is no measuring the Buddha Shakyamuni. So be free from doubt. The Buddha never leaves this world, and the Dharma never disappears. The Buddha is eternal. The Buddha field is inconceivable beyond the mind of man. All the Buddhas are one, and the eternal Buddha manifests here in many ways for the sake of sentient beings. Now, it strikes me that it wasn't really necessary for the Buddhas to say anything. If you're wondering why the Buddha isn't a living presence in your life, and your house dissolves into infinity, and four enormous Buddhas appear in the four directions, then I think you've had your answer, actually. The medium is the message. I think you've had your answer. You've been told, in no uncertain terms, that transcendent reality is present and active. And that it can be a living reality in your life, if you open up to it. But just in case Ruchirakhetu didn't get the point, the Buddhas spell it out to him. The Buddhas spell it out to him. The Buddha is eternal. The Buddha field is inconceivable. The Buddha never leaves this world and the Dharma never disappears. The eternal Buddha manifests here in many ways for the sake of sentient beings. The Buddha is a living reality, my friend, they're saying, if you hadn't quite cottoned on to that, and we're here to prove it to you. Now, not surprisingly, this is all a bit of an overwhelming experience for a Tricata, as you might imagine. He's created a sort of chink in his worldly reality by meditating on the Buddha. He's opened up a chink, and the transcendental reality has gushed in with overpowering force, washing away any possibility of doubt. He's created a chink in his ordinary experience of the world, and an overwhelming light has shone through that chink, and shown him that reality is more wonderful than he could possibly have imagined. The link between him and what is ultimate in the universe has been renewed. He can hardly have any doubt about it now, can he? His Shraddha is completely restored. And this sets off a train of inner events that completely transforms Ruchiraketu and his world. Firstly, he enters a sort of dream state, in which he sees Buddhas everywhere. And he sees a holy man beating a vast golden drum, which as it's beaten sends out not only sound, but also golden light beaming out in all directions. So he has entered the visionary dimension of experience, in which the senses are not strictly separate, where sounds are also colours, and where colours are also mental states. So the drum doesn't just boom out sound and beam out light. It sends out verses that represent the next phase of Ruchiraketu's great spiritual experience. These verses represent what's happening in the depths of Ruchiraketu's being, in response to this renewal of his Shraddha, this renewal of his connection with the transcendental. These are verses expressing joy, massive joy, and verses expressing devotion to the Buddha, beautiful verses expressing devotion to the Buddha, verses expressing a wonderful sense of joyous well-wishing to all beings. And there are also verses of confession, of regret for past unskillfulness, and of a determination to move on, to live according to the Dharma, to act more in accord with what's ultimate within him. So there's this wonderful joyousness about them, this wonderful metta about them, but there's also these verses of confession. As Padmavajra said yesterday, the golden light that beams out is wonderful, it's transformative, but it also burns. It burns what blocks it. It burns the old patterns that are stopping it from manifesting. It burns what is in us, the habits that we have got into, which prevent it from entering us. So it burns Ruchiraketu, and the form of that burning takes are these verses of confession, these verses of regret for his unskillful past, if you like, for his unskillful tendencies, the patterns in him that block the light. Now, I'm not going to say a lot about this confession. It's actually quite a central feature of the sutra. I'm not going to say a lot about it, this confessional aspect of Ruchiraketu's experience, because Padmavajra, I think, is going to talk more about that tomorrow in more detail. But I do need to say a couple of things quite briefly, because just to make sense of the sutra in a way. Because in a way, confession is an essential part of Ruchiraketu's spiritual experience. Confession, actually, is an essential part of any spiritual transformation, and that's what's going on with him. To become a new being, we need to leave the old being behind. We can't sort of carry the old being with us like a sort of corpse. We have to leave the old being behind. That means we need to stop identifying with old patterns of behaviour. The old patterns of behaviour that make up, if you like, our old idea of ourself. And confession is a really powerful practice to help us do this. We might have sort of rather negative connotations for it from other spiritual traditions, but it's actually a really positive thing. It's a really powerful practice to help us leave behind the old stuff, leave behind the old self, the old patterns. And part of the reason for this is, well, our sort of identification, while we're not willing to move on, we identify with our unskillful patterns. We think they're me. They seem to be me. Because they're not very nice, we either deny them, even to ourselves. Oh, I'm not like that. I'm really very good-tempered. I never get angry. Etc., etc. We either deny them to ourselves, or else we defend them. We say things like, well, that's just human nature. Or, well, anyone would have behaved like that. Or, well, he deserved it. What did he expect? Or whatever. We defend our unskillfulness. Or we deny it. Because it's not very nice. We think it's me. So we've got to find some way to either make me okay. It's either I don't have it or it's just natural. But when we confess, we do one of two things which completely cuts across these ways that we sort of hang on to old patterns of behaviour. For one thing, we're open about them. We stop denying them. We're open about them. This is true. And that can be quite powerful. That can be quite disturbing, but quite powerful. This actually is the way I am. This is the way I behave. We're not denying it. So we own up to them, at least to ourselves, but perhaps, more importantly, to others sometimes, perhaps. And the second thing we do is we stop defending them. We're not saying any longer, well, it's just human nature, or well, he deserved it, or anyone would have done that, or well, of course, that was okay. We say, that was ugly. I don't like that. I don't like that at all. We regret it. We express regret. That was harmful. That harmed me. That harmed others. We stop defending them. We admit that they're harmful and stupid. We feel regret. So together, this openness and this admitting unskillful patterns are unskillful allows us to let go of them. We stop seeing them as me, and we start seeing them as habits that this bit of consciousness has got into, but this bit of consciousness can get out of. They're not necessarily me. They're just habits. We can let go. So confession is a really important part of Rucharakata's experience, his transformation. He regrets the patterns that he got into while his link to the transcendental, to what's highest in the universe, was weak. And he feels a feeling of joy and rejoicing and metta as he commits himself firmly to the spiritual life, as fully and wholeheartedly as he can. So he steps out of his old self and into a new self with a new sense of meaning and commitment. He is going to live the Dharma. He's sure of that. He is going to live the Dharma. Four Buddhas have appeared to him in infinite space in the four directions. He's going to live that out. He's going to live the Dharma. And as he's following, he's described as a bodhisattva. He's someone following the bodhisattva path. So living the Dharma for him is going to mean practicing not just for self, but practicing selflessness. It's going to mean teaching the Dharma, spreading the Dharma, building Sangha. It's going to mean not just practicing for the self, but practicing for all, doing it for others, for the world, doing it in a way that transforms not only him, but transforms the world. So he steps out of his old personality and into this new personality as a new being, wholeheartedly committed to the bodhisattva path. And as a result, something else happens. The next stage of his spiritual journey happens. Something that at first sight might seem a bit weird, but is in fact an expression of some deep spiritual truths. So what happens is that a number of very strange figures appear in the sutra and give various different sorts of blessing, not just on him, but on us as we share in his experience, and on the whole world. These strange figures come from Indian culture, so they may seem unfamiliar to us. But if we can get beyond that, we can see that they represent something really important and significant. What they represent, taken together, if you like, is the blessing, the abundance, the power, the strength, the effectiveness, the fulfillment, the happiness, the joy that comes from wholeness, that comes from what some psychologists call integration, from wholeness of character, from having a personality that is united around something higher than one's normal ego, than one's normal self. Without the usual conflicts and uncertainties that usually undermine us and create all sorts of mental and emotional suffering. So these figures that come and bless, they represent the fact that when we become whole, when we become united around a higher purpose, the world becomes brighter and more beautiful and more vivid, and we become able to create brightness and beauty and vividness around us. To paraphrase the poet W.B. Yeats, we are blessed and we can bless. I don't think this is a theory. This isn't just a theory that this happens. This is, I think, people's experience. And it's also, if you think about people you admire, if you think about people who seem to carry that other, carry that sort of strength and clarity and, you know, that are just clearly admirable beings, then you will find that they know what their life is about, that their life is about something beyond themselves. And they live that wholly and fully. And that creates admirable beings, that creates the sort of person who's a magnet for others. So, Ruta Rakeitu has left behind the doubts that cut him off from the ideal. He's become reconnected with what is ultimate, through this renewal of his Shraddha, and this has the effect of making him whole, of unifying his energies. Some of these figures represent his energies. Ruta Rakeitu is now definitely about something. His life is about something. He's whole. He's blessed. When we know what our life is about, especially when it's about something bigger than our own wants and anxieties, and especially when our life is about the most important project of all, which is the evolution of consciousness on this planet, as Ruta Rakeitu is, then something happens. We take on a new weight. We take on a new strength. Our talents and our powers come on stream, and they're raised to a new level. Something beyond our usual self starts feeding power into our worldly personality. We become able to do things that we could never have done before. We even may start to be lucky. The universe starts to cooperate with us, to help us. And all this is represented by the figures that appear to bless us as we share in Ruta Rakeitu's transformative spiritual experience and the blessings of his wholeness. So the first of these strange figures to appear are what are called the four great kings. The four great kings who in Indian mythology stand at the four corners of the world and protect the world of men, bringing order and harmony to the world of men. And for me, these four great kings are really cracking symbols of integration, of psychological and emotional wholeness, wholeness of character. The circle is a universal symbol of wholeness, and they stand in a circle protecting the world of men, creating a protective mandala around the world of men. The number four is also a common symbol of wholeness, and there are four of them in the four quarters. So in response to Ruta Rakeitu's new commitment, wholeness, his higher purpose than his own wants and fears, and his commitment to that, the four great kings promise to bring order and harmony to the world. If you like, to his inner world. But that will have the effect of bringing it to the outer world. The four great kings promise to bring order and harmony to his inner world. So they, among the things that they say, is they chant together. By the chanting of this sutra, our bodies swell with power. By the nectar of this dharma, our bodies shine with splendor. Through hearing this sutra, we will rule by the dharma. By the dharma, we will order all the gods and the powers. In the depths, we will rule the nagas. We will order the fierce yakshas. We will rout the chaotic buddhas who take their glory from others. So, we will order all the gods and the powers. The gods and the powers, we could say, are the energies of our being. Nagas are sort of serpent beings that live in the depths. They could be very, very good symbols of sort of unconscious energies. Yakshas are fierce, demonic beings that we'll come across a bit more later on. Real raw animal energy. I have absolutely no idea what Buddhas are. So we will rule the Nagas, we will order the fierce Yakshas, we will rout the chaotic Buddhas. I don't know what Buddhas are.
Ghosts.
Perhaps some, sorry? Ghosts, are they? Ghosts. Okay. But they're chaotic. So chaos is the opposite of harmony. They bring the opposite of harmony. They bring chaos. So for me, they sort of, all of this, but particularly perhaps the Buddhas, but all of this symbolise sort of the inner chaos of conflicting drives. And we're going to be invoking this blessing in the puja this evening. I think it's going to be quite significant that it's Halloween. So out there in the world, all sorts of mischievous little beings will be creating a nuisance if they don't get the sweeties that they're after. As with us, all sorts of mischievous little beings sometimes create quite a nuisance if they don't get the sweeties they're after. And as all out there in the world, all these mischievous little beings are going to be creating a nuisance, we in our puja are going to be invoking the four great kings, bringing harmony, getting all those little beings into some sort of harmonious conjunction. So I think it's quite significant that we'll be doing this puja on Halloween. We'll be sort of, it'll be with the chaos of Halloween around us, we will be creating order. So the four great kings come and they promise to establish order with all these different energies, these different strange beings standing in the four corners of the world. And another figure that appears to bless us as we share in Rucha Aketa's experience, is the general of the Yakshas, the general of the fierce demonic Yakshas, that the four great kings have already referred to. Now, we could see Yakshas, these sort of fierce, huge, fierce warrior beings, as certain aspects of our animal energies, especially our aggression, our anger and irritation. All the energy that gets tied up in useless sort of resentment and irritation and criticism and frustration, but which we can use skillfully when our life is focused and dedicated to the Dharma and the Sangha. So this enormous, fierce warrior general appears and he chants, "I and my fellow Yaksha generals will go wherever we hear this sutra. Protect whoever teaches the Dharma, defend and help him and deliver him from danger. We will inject strength into the roots of his hair. We will produce great energy in his body. We will fill him with vigor and prowess so that his body will not be weary, so that his body may have happy senses, so that he may be full of joy, so that this Dharma may long go forth in Jambudvipa." Jambudvipa is the world, basically. So, we will inject strength into the roots of his hair. I love that line. We will produce great energy in his body. A lot of our energy is tied up in quite coarse, even aggressive drives. Yakshas. And we need to get the yakshas on our side. On the side of our spiritual practice. We need to be not just nice, but also to have, if you like, the full energy of that working for us. As Sangharakshita has said, the only nice Buddhist is a dead Buddhist. We need to be live Buddhists. We need to have our energy, not just to sort of trampled it down and become pale. We need to have our energy. And commitment to a higher ideal gets the yakshas working for us. It injects strength into our hair roots. So our commitment to a higher cause gets our energy going. Gets our energy going. It orders our being, orders our energies, and gets our energy going. And it also brings our worldly talents on stream. It raises them to a new level because they're fed by an energy that comes from something a bit higher than ourselves. Instead of being, as they often are, undermined by our own doubts and conflicts and anxieties and lack of confidence. So to represent this, one of the strange figures that appears in Blessedness is the goddess of learning, Sarasvati. She appears and offers her blessing, saying that, "I, dear Lord, the goddess of learning, will adorn the speech of whoever teaches the Dharma. I will make his speech eloquent. I will arrange the order of his presentation. I will shine the light of knowledge into his mind. I will protect his memory, so that this excellent king of sutras may long go forth in Janbudvipa. So I will adorn the speech of whoever teaches the Dharma, make his speech eloquent, arrange the order of his presentation, shine the light of knowledge into his eyes." So yes, our worldly talents come on stream. They're really raised to the level they could be because they're dedicated to something higher than ourselves, so we're not constantly undermining them by all our inner problems. And something beyond ourselves start to feed energy into them. So all of that happens when we are whole, when we're whole behind a higher ideal, as Ruchiraketu has become. So when our life becomes about something higher than ourselves, our energy flows freely, our energies are harmonized, and our talents are raised to a new level. But something else happens as well. Something magical happens. We start to get lucky. And you can, I won't offer this, I won't argue about this. I'm just going to offer this as a operational concept you might work with. And if you try it out, you might find that you get lucky if this happens. It is as though, if we're doing what we're here for, if we're doing the universe's work, the universe starts to support and help us. As the German poet Goethe, well, he's actually quoted as saying this, I'm not sure he actually did, but he says, "The moment one definitely commits oneself, then providence moves too. All sorts of things occur to help one that would never otherwise have happened. A whole stream of events issue from the decision, raising in one's favour all manner of unforeseen incidents and meetings and material assistance which no man would have dreamed would have come his way. Boldness has genius, magic and power in it." So he's saying the same thing. I said, when we're united, when our being is whole around a higher cause, a cause higher than ourselves, we get lucky. He says, providence moves too. All sorts of things to occur to help one. So, in our sutra, this magical help, magical cooperation from the universe is symbolized, among other things, by the goddess of wealth. The goddess of wealth symbolizes this, for one thing, her blessings. She promises to provide for those who teach the Dharma. To give them clothes and food, to give them bed and lodging, and all the things they need for living. So she's saying, go down that path, give yourself wholeheartedly to that path, and you will be taken care of. The universe will take care of you. You don't have to worry about your pension. You don't have to worry about where the grub's going to come from. It will come. You're doing the universe's work. The universe will cooperate. The universe will look after someone who is doing the universe's work. And this help is also alluded to by the four great kings. I mean, they promise, "We, the four great kings of the earth's four quarters, each with his guard of 500 yakshas, will always follow those that hold this sutra to watch and protect and honour those teachers." So it's as though there's powers that come into existence which protect us, which represent this fact of the universe, as it were, looking after us, cooperating with us. Providence moves too. So all those things happen. When our life is about something bigger than ourselves, we get our energies become harmonized, we get new energy or energy from the full energy of our being, our talents are raised to a new level, and the universe cooperates with us. But something else happens as well. For us, the world is transformed. It looks completely different. The world looks completely different. The shadow that our inner conflicts usually cast on the world around us, making it sort of seem a bit of a dark and threatening place, they simply vanish. They're lifted, and the world quite simply looks a better place. More beautiful, more amazing, more abundant, more colourful, more vivid. And we start to have a positive effect on the world as well. We start to help others to experience better mental states, more wholeness. We have a transformative effect. The beauty and colour overflows from our inner world. So this is partly seems to be symbolised in the sutra by the blessings of the earth goddess, Dredha. So the earth goddess Dredha appears and promises to make the place a more, make the earth a more beautiful and abundant place for us. She says, wherever on earth this Dharma is heard, I will go into that place, walking under the earth with my invisible body. I will go up to that Dharma teacher and I will touch my head to the soles of his feet. I will pay deep respects. I will drink deeply from the Dharma. And the nectar juice of the Dharma will make my body grow vivid, full of glory and fortune. And as my body swells, so this great earth from ocean to ocean and down to its diamond core will grow more fragrant and colourful, moister and greener, tastier and greater. And all the lawns and shrubs will grow brighter. All the plants and trees will grow stronger. All the trees in parks and groves, each leaf and flower, every fruit and crop will grow tastier and more fragrant, moister and more abundant. And all those beings that depend on the earth will become stronger and brighter, clear-skinned and comely, larger, longer-lived, with vivid senses. And beings will enjoy all the blessings of this earth, the food and the drink, the clothes and the beds, the houses and the palaces, the parks and the pools, the springs and the rivers, the landscapes, towns and villages. And beings will listen to the Dharma, and everywhere that they talk about the Dharma, in that place the earth and everything on it will grow more intense, moister and more fragrant. So the Dharma has this blessing quality. It transforms the earth because it transforms people. It transforms the perceivers of the earth. And we can use this sutra to share to that to some extent in the spirit, that spiritual experience. And to the extent that we do that, our world will be blessed. Our mental disturbances will be pacified. We will be blessed and protected. We will experience inner harmony. So the extent that we share in that experience of Rucharaketa, all that will happen, our world will be blessed. But also we will become deeper, clearer people. And deeper, clearer people transform the world around them. What the world needs is not the right political system, it needs deep people. It needs wise people, compassionate people, clear people. Clear people, deep people transform the world. The more deep people, the more we make ourselves like that, the more we actually transform the world. The world will look different to us, but we will also transform the world objectively. So the traditional reputation of this sutra as a text that can bring blessing and protection and abundance, I think it's got some real basis. If we can take part in this experience, if we can share in this experience, to that extent, it will have a blessing effect on us and on our world, a protective effect, a bringing of abundance effect. Okay, just by chanting it by rote, it's not going to protect our nation or avoid disaster. Or maybe it will, I don't know. I mean, there's more between heaven and earth than dreamt of in my philosophy, I'm sure. Maybe it will. I can't see how, but I can very much see how really engaging with this sutra will bless us and bless our world, or taking, as it were, sharing in the experience that this sutra describes will bless us. and bless our world. And what is certain is that if we open up more to Shraddha, if we strengthen the connection between what is ultimate in us and what is ultimate in the universe, if we cultivate our admiration and longing for spiritual qualities and decide to allow our life to be more guided by that connection, something will happen. Something serious will happen. We can do this by opening up to, by taking part in puja, really engaging in puja, by opening up to beauty in all its forms, by cultivating the capacity of reverence, by making the intellect serve the values that we really cherish rather than using it to undermine them or allowing it to rule in its own right, by paying attention to, I mean, perhaps a dim intuitive sense of direction, a sort of heart knowledge, a sort of knowledge that that's the right way to go, by paying attention to that, by not discounting it, by feeding it, nurturing it, and living by it as much as we can, doing the things that that cultivate it. By doing all of that, something will happen. And we can help this something to happen by engaging in the puja that we're going to take part in this evening, leaving our skeptical mind outside, allowing ourselves to enter the mythical world of this sutra of golden light, letting ourselves enjoy this bit of spiritual theatre, allowing it to transform us as we would allow a stage play perhaps to transform us. And okay, we probably won't be completely transformed over the weekend. That would be nice, wouldn't it? But this can be part of a process. All those things are part of a process, which, if we follow it to the end, will completely transform us and our world. We will live in a new world entirely, a pure land. The world will really be, as we are promised at the end of this sutra, at the end of the puja we're going to do tonight, it tells us, and then all those Buddhas in the 10 directions, all those great beings, all those gods of the skies, all those Nagas of the deeps, all those armies of Yakshas, and in Jambudvipa, all the deities of fruit and crop, the gods of groves and forests, will all be pleased, will all resound their blessing, all at one time, with one voice, with one resounding voice. And the sky will become clear, free of smoke and cloud. The four quarters of the sky, with darkness and dust removed, will shine brilliantly. The sun, shining brightly with his 1,000 rays, with his massive beams, rejoicing in his deep brilliance, will rise in the sky. The lordly sun, offspring of the gods, residing in his palace of gold, will be glad. The lordly sun will rise in Jambudvipa, greatly rejoicing. He will shine everywhere with his endless masses of rays, waking the flowers and the lotuses in the clear pools. He will ripen the crops, fruit and plants. He will satisfy the whole earth, and the moon will shine clearly. The constellations will wheel harmoniously in their proper courses. The sun and rain will come at their proper times. And there will be peace and plenty everywhere in this Jambudvipa.